Good morning. I'm opening today's meeting of the House Revenue Committee. I expect the rest of the committee members will be coming in shortly. We have three bills before us for discussion as a way of, because I think most of the people are going to speak, or a lot of people are going to speak on all three rather than having people coming back and forth. I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2572, House Bill 2569, and House Bill 2570 all at the same time so that folks can speak on all three bills at the same time. And Christine, if you'd speak about these bills and give us a little background, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2569 would allow assessors to issue a deferred billing credit to taxpayers who have an appeal in with over $1 million at issue. So this would allow them to have the money refunded to the person ahead of time while the appeal is decided, and it would avoid the necessity to pay interest to the person if the appeal is later decided in the favor of the taxpayer. House Bill 2570, it deals with the date in which a person can become a bona fide purchaser of a property. When tax rolls are subsequently corrected or property is added to a tax roll, there is the person who is a bona fide purchaser in a given year will be exempt from having to pay the property tax in that year. And this moves the date in which a person will be eligible for this. It used to be on, or current law provides that it would be on January 1st, the assessment date. And the time after that, a person, if they bought the property in that year, would be exempt from later roll changes. But this measure proposes to move the date to October, which is the date the roll is actually certified. And if a person purchases the property after that year, in that part of the year, then they would be exempt for that year. But if they purchased it before, they would be subject to rule changes for that year in which they bought the property. And House Bill 2572 allows all parties to a property tax appeal to seek a determination from the court on the real market value of the property tax account as a whole. Oftentimes, what will happen is one portion of the account can be appealed, and if the value is reduced, the other properties to the appeal can ask that the body or tribunal look at the property as a whole and possibly reassess the values of the property as a whole.
Thank you. I'm going to start with House Bill 2569. We'll kind of work on that bill first, but if you have comments on the other bills while you're up here and want to make them, that's why I have opened it up. We'll take these in order of those who signed up, and it starts with Randy Waldruff. And if you'd like to come up as a panel, please feel free. Gil Riddell, and is it Annette Spitchard? I can't read the writing, but if you'd like to come up as a panel, Gil, you can.
Okay. John's being shy.
You can go back and forth. Please identify yourselves.
Why don't I, Madam Chair, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. This is a concept presented to you by the assessors from the Assessors Association, and it might be at your discretion value to have them describe the concept, and then we could, with John's Phillips' superb help, could help state the context, why it's a problem, why we want it addressed, need it addressed, and the activities we had as a work group just before the session. So, do that.
Okay. That's fine.
Good morning, Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Annette Spickard. I'm the Lane County Assessor and also a member of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. And I'll speak at the end, and I'll let my colleagues here introduce themselves.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Randy Walroff. I'm the Multnomah County Assessor. And I have with me...
Good morning, Chair Berger and members of the committee. This is I'm Jed Tompkins, Assistant Multnomah County Attorney.
So the first bill that we have here, 2569, is the deferred billing credit. And the logic behind this, it was first written in response to a lot of questions that arose around the Comcast appeal and setting up the reserve account. So it brought this back to the forefront of the large appeals where it takes a substantial amount of time to bring these tax court cases to resolution, and the interest is ticking at 12%. So we came up with the concept after collaborating as an association of how can we mitigate that interest and still protect the taxpayers' rights. So what we came up with is a deferred billing credit, and what we are doing here is the property will be assessed and the tax determined per the normal course. Nothing will change about that. Appraise the property, calculate the taxes, certify them to the tax roll. But then a collection of a portion of the tax will be deferred until the appeal is resolved. The result is that large interest debts will not accrue on taxes for which the collection is deferred. And this creates a fairness for the taxpayers because they will still collect 12% interest on any further refunds ordered by the court. That would happen in a situation where perhaps the deferred billing credit was not as large as the refund that ended up being ordered. They collect 12% interest on any credits that include the return of tax payments. This has been written so that it can be done at any time. So we could go back and issue a refund as an example, the Comcast case for last year. So if they do prevail, they would receive 12% interest from when they paid the tax up to the point where we issue them the deferred billing credit. They do not pay interest on any credited amount because they get to retain the use of the money until the dispute is resolved. That's the key concept there. We looked at this, and the problem goes just beyond a large one. Comcast brought it to our attention. But we've set this up so that the assessor may order a deferred billing credit when there's more than $1 million in property value appealed. The threshold may be exceeded in a single year, or if the appeal takes a number of years. Sometimes we have appeals that take 5 and 6 years to settle, and all those years are starting to accumulate. The threshold was based on a collaboration of the assessors looking at what will work for all counties in the state of Oregon, not just Multnomah County, where $5 million is a lot in Multnomah County, and other counties, $1 million is a high threshold for them. Again, the credit may be issued at any time during litigation, and a lot of it is based on litigation risk. We look at this as another tool in the assessor's toolbox in managing the litigation and the appeal process.
Could we stop here? I am not familiar with the Comcast case. So since this came out of the Comcast case, does somebody want to give us a quick... would that be helpful to anybody besides me? Thank you.
Chair Berger, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips, the Oregon Department of Revenue. And as you might have heard before, the department appraises certain properties and the counties appraise certain properties. So we typically would appraise the large industrial accounts and what are referred to as utility accounts. So that's airlines, railroad, communications companies. And an issue came up several years ago because we're appraising, let's say, to name some names, Quest. We'd appraised AT&T. We appraised phone companies for their communication services because the statute says that we are to appraise communications companies. And so at the time that cable was moving sort of from, over a long period of time, cable moved from a black wire to your house that just sent you a signal to actually where you can now communicate two ways via your computer in your home via your cable. And so at some point, we decided that what we're looking at now are communications companies that previously were not. So we began assessing them as centrally assessed or utility companies that the department would appraise. And that that decision was not taken lightly, and we brought it to you, and we said, this is what we're going to do 2 years from now. Please let us know if this is wrong. And we didn't hear anything. We began appraising them, and they filed a lawsuit, and they're appealing their assessment under the central assessment statute. So it's a very big case. Comcast is the main litigant, but all of the other cable companies in Oregon, I believe, or most, have joined that case. So in Multnomah County, that's, actually, there's 10 counties affected, I think, by the Comcast, and then I think all counties are pretty much brought in by virtue of the fact that they have cable companies. Is that the kind of background you're looking for?
That helps. Questions? Before we go on? Okay.
Chair, I would add, in the Comcast case in Multnomah County alone, the interest, if they prevail, is in excess of $40,000 per month. So if we had this deferred billing credit in place and allowed Comcast to keep their money under this scheme here, they would not be receiving that interest if they prevail, but they've been able to keep their money and use it for their business operations. And then when we do prevail, we would issue the billing credit, and then they would have 30 days to pay it the 15th of the following month.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on the HB 2569, the deferred credit, would this authorize a credit only for the property whose value is currently in dispute on an annual basis, or would this allow the assessor to grant a billing credit for the entire parcel on an annual basis? Do you see where I'm getting at on that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The intent of this is that we would, with a property under appeal, could issue a deferred billing credit for what is determined to be the litigation risk up to the amount being claimed. So in this example, with Comcast in Multnomah County, the risk is, it turns out to be $4 million in taxes per year out of the $5 million. They used to be locally assessed, paying around $1 million a year. I'm going to use some generalities.
Sure, yeah.
So the difference is another $4 million in taxes and quite a substantial value, obviously. In the litigation risk, we could choose to use it at $3 million and refund that much, or the entire $4 million. But we would not go to the $5 million because that's not what's being protested. It's the based on the valuation difference up to the amount that the litigant is claiming.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So what you're saying then is any money that has already been collected by the county for a prior tax year for which interest is currently accruing, that's going to continue on. This bill doesn't solve that. All this bill does is prevent a snowball effect to have additional principal sums moving forward during the litigation, then including interest on top of those.
Actually, this was written, and Jed is helped with all the legal part of it, to actually we could retroactively issue that credit for a prior year.
You would be able to issue this credit, as the bill's written now, for any tax year that's still under appeal. And the way the Section 2 provides that the Act would apply to appeals active on or filed on or after the effective date of the Act. And it's crafted that way to assist counties in particular in the Comcast case here.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Reed, you had
a quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps it's obvious somewhere that I'm not seeing or to everyone else, but in the case, in the situation where this would be used, does interest continue to accrue on the amount that's in question? And if the county were to prevail later on, would the taxpayer owe that amount plus interest?
No. This has been set up so that they're not accruing any interest, but we're not accruing any interest. It was to try to keep a level playing field so that it wouldn't be looked at as us also trying to game the system. So there was a lot of discussion around that fact, but we're trying to issue this deferred billing credit to mitigate having to pay the 12% interest. So straight up, the answer is no. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the surface, it sounds like this is a taxpayer-friendly bill, but I am greatly concerned about it for a couple reasons. One is, in Section 2B, you talk about it being applicable to a single business enterprise, regardless of whether the property is the subject of separate appeals or owned by separate taxpayers. The definition of what is a single business enterprise is somewhat subjective. The fact that you now remove the county's ability or requirement to pay 12% interest removes any risk from the county from over-assessing. And so they can over-assess without risk at this point because they can simply issue a deferred bill or deferred credit to the taxpayers and cause a taxpayer to appeal. What you've done now is created a no-risk ability to assess against the taxpayer against this whatever you define as a single business enterprise.
I think there's two questions there. I'm going to let
there was, that was a statement to be.
Oh, okay. Well, as far as the risk of over-assessing, the risk is high regardless of the interest. We need to try to get it right to begin with and have appeals resolved as expeditiously as possible. And the reason being is eventually the right answer will be arrived at through the courts. And it's not to the assessor's office benefit or the taxing district's benefit to assess property higher than it ultimately will be determined to be found, because that refund will occur with or without the interest, and that refund comes from the unsegregated tax account. And it's very conceivable that those properties, the revenue that came from that went to specific taxing districts, and then the property refund comes from the unsegregated tax account, which means all the taxing districts pay for this. And the assessors that I've dealt with, they're very dedicated to having the right values on the roll to begin with and resolving appeals timely. I looked back, and I don't have the spreadsheet with me. We looked yesterday, and there's 500 instances in Multnomah County in the last 6 years where this law could possibly have been used, which includes aggregating accounts together. On the issue of an enterprise, many of our appeals involve units of property, but you could have 6, 8, 10, 16 accounts. Tomorrow I'm doing a mediation on an industrial property in Northwest Portland. They have 16 accounts. Some of those accounts individually don't meet the threshold, but the aggregate together is around $60 million in value at risk. This appeal at the moment is going back for 4 years. So we are ready to settle this case, and this would be one additional tool to help mitigate that interest. We have another tool in the toolbox, which is the assessor can make a unilateral reduction, but that would be in the case where the assessor is willing to accept a lower value. The legislature approved this, I believe it was two sessions ago. Previously, we could not reduce a value under appeal until the case was settled, even if we wanted to lower the value. We taxpayer came forward and said, you're assessing me too high. We say, yes, you're right, but your value is too low. We'd have to wait, sometimes 5 and 6 years. I had a personal property case that took close to 10 years by the time it went through the system. So that gave us one tool. But this is the next tool on top of it, which is to help mitigate this interest in the case when we still want to fight for that higher value. I don't know if that answers your question or your statement.
Follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Single business enterprise is that in itself is a big term that causes great conflict. And this is, to me, very loose language unless you can tell me definitively what it includes and excludes. But my observation is a single business enterprise is up for much discussion. And when you're throwing it all together to equal $1 million of tax, not a million of value, but a million of tax, we're talking a very large value attached to that. And so a single business enterprise to me is very troubling. And this does remove, and I know that you believe, and I believe, that the desire is to create an accurate assessment from the get-go, but it does remove virtually all risk from the county assessors, and it puts it completely on the taxpayer, and they have to now rebut the position of the value.
Chair Brewer, this is Jed Tompkins for Multnomah County. I understand your concerns. I think the thought here was that when we are dealing in situations of large appeals, there is so much value at issue other than the interest payments that that is what would guide proper conduct on both sides. But in terms of what you're talking about on the county assessor's side, local governments do budget projections, they forecast, they plan ahead, and it's not in their interest to plan for over assessments, especially large value over assessments. So to the extent that relieves any of your concern, I offer that. I'll also just point out the idea in 2B, this is Section 1, Subsection 2B, is to allow local governments to benefit from this bill without worrying about taxpayers getting around the threshold requirement by separating their appeals out, which they could do if they have property in separate property tax accounts. It's not to give local governments some sword that they can wave around. And then the only other thing I'd add is my suspicion in looking at this 2B is that is not going to happen all that often. I know that the language single business entity is loose, as you mentioned. In terms of advising my client, if I was asked, the risk of it, well, if we think that if a county thinks that there's a single business entity, we actually get to a situation where we're actually looking at 2B again, I think it's going to be less common than some of the other situations. If we're wrong, I would be willing to put that to a magistrate or the tax court judge to decide that term at that time.
John, did you have something to say on this?
Hey, Madam Chair, Representative Eric Brewer. I think one of the reasons why the term chosen might not be, something everybody might like is because it was really difficult to choose a term. We have accounts on all of the appraisals that we do, and typically any site, like Intel, for example, has dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of accounts. So for any site, then you've got the company. And the company might have, like in Representative Berger will remember this, the NORPAC appeal about 5 years ago, where the NORPAC has three plants in the area. And the appeal initially started at the Board of Property Tax Appeals, and all the accounts were appealed. And then when they went on to magistrate, they were combined. And now we have the effect of three large plants under appeal. And then so the challenge was when drafting this legislation, okay, how do we characterize the three plants as being one appeal when, in fact, that's what they would be. It would be one refund. It would be interest. And so to just say accounts would be wrong, to just say site would be wrong, to say company, I'm not an expert on what company might mean, but I think the effort was to try to capture that. Because in that refund, you know, 40% of that refund is paid for by the schools, and the Staten Fire District pays some of that, and there is no NORPAC plant in Staten. So it's like, how do we not harm the taxpayer and hold the local governments harmless? And nobody gets interest on either side this way, and this was one of the solutions that came up. But I think the real effort was try to nail down the situation where we got one company with multiple sites, plants, and accounts.
Representative Benz, do you have something to add here that might get us...
actually,
or a
no,
question
I'm
on some other subject?
Some other subject.
Okay, let me...
Same subject.
Okay.
If I might. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the interest payment, what I hear from Representative Ayer Brewer is a commentary about, in the framework of the 12% being intended as a penalty or a deterrent to the assessor to avoid improper assessments. The way that I initially looked at this, perhaps incorrectly, is that the 12% is intended as a payment for the loss of use of funds. So what I'm wondering, my question is, do we have any insight into why this is 12% when the statutory interest rate on contract rate is 9% in this state? And do we have any history that can guide us regarding whether this is intended as a penalty or a loss of use?
That is a very good question. Who wants to field?
Madam Chair, Representative Wand. I don't have the specific history research recently on that 12%, although... I did recently research some other interest rates, and these rates haven't been changed, in the last 10 years, to my recollection. And there was a time when interest rates were a little bit higher, but in the last 10 years, there's been a hesitancy to change either one for fear of affecting the other. So that's been a concern, for which there are also bills open this session to discuss that. But. So I guess the answer is no. I don't know the history on that.
I think that we could spend hours on this subject alone, and I've been around this long enough to know that systems such as this grow, and if you were out of something and if you were to start from scratch, you probably wouldn't do things the way we do them. That being said, I would encourage that the proponents of this bill might want to talk to Representative Brewer about alternative language that would be better here, because this bill certainly would be amendable if we can come up with something. But I appreciate this may not be doable, but let's kind of look into some other way in this 2B of expressing this, and then if you're willing, we'll move on to whatever Representative Benz wants to ask a question about.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because I paid to let the opportunity pass, I'll just mention that to me, if I was handling the appeal, the fact that I now knew I wasn't going to be subjected in representing the taxpayer to that exposure, the 12% would be a great big deal and make it more likely that I would actually appeal it. And so I think the cut both ways analysis is the correct analysis. But that's not my question. My question actually goes to Section 5, and I see that the county assessor is held to a standard, quote, necessary to address the risk presented by an appeal. And I thought that's an it's interesting that that standard appears, and I just wonder why it's necessary.
Representative Benz, Jed Tompkins from Multnomah County. I think that provision is intended in part to be definitional. There's no section that defines deferred billing credit, but the bill taken as a whole, you can see what the characteristics of a deferred billing credit are. And there's, without that provision, there is nothing that says how much this is going to be or gives any guidance to assessors or counties on what it is that how to use this, and so it's it sort of describes what this credit is, I think, is the purpose of that section.
Follow up.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I raised the issue, of course, leads to the next question, and that is whether the issuance of the credit is irrevocable. because, of course, if I was the county assessor, I would sit there and estimate where I thought I would end up, and I would adjust the credit accordingly. And then as I watched the thing progress through, I might want to adjust it again. So I could constantly keep metering my credit up and down to fit how I thought the ultimate outcome might look.
I think that this bill would allow you to issue further credit. I don't think there are provisions in there to ask for some of the money back.
Yes.
Thank you. The way I view the credit, it's a paper credit. You don't get anything back. You just don't have to pay it. You're not at risk, is the way to put it, I guess. Is that correct? Or are you?
Well, that could be one scenario. You may issue an assessor could issue a credit prior to the payment of taxes. But take, for instance, this Comcast appeal that we've been discussing, or any appeal after which taxes have been paid already. An assessor could issue a credit at that time. Issuing the credit would be a notice. You would do it by issuing a notice. It would also come together with a return of paid taxes. And you'll note here that in that instance, since the counties have held the taxpayers' money for some period of time, the 12% interest would accrue on that amount.
One follow-up?
Sure.
Thank you. So having returned the money, one wouldn't think we would ask for it back if we were the assessor. So this would only be the irrevocable nature of the device only comes into play if it's a paper credit. That is, they haven't paid it and they appeal it. Is there ever a situation like that, or do they have to, when they file the appeal, have to pay something?
I believe the question, they paid, Oregon's a pay and play. Your tax bill in the fall is your notice, and you pay your taxes, and then you appeal. I think that answers the question.
It does. Thank you.
Yes. Further questions? Okay. Gil, what?
A couple of clarifying comments, if I may, Mr. Chair. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. First of all, the bill, to answer Representative Air Brewer, the threshold relates to the property value, not the tax liability. Secondly, the 12% interest rate was thoroughly discussed 22 years ago now, in the context of the Assessment and Taxation Funding Program. And I expect that this committee will get into that in some detail later in the session. There's a couple of bills that relate directly to that, and it's quite complex, and we're happy to help with that. I have never heard it described as the interest rate as a penalty against the assessor. It's always, in my experience, been described as lack of use, precisely what Representative Juan said. So this was a new thought that I've heard that about that. The issue is not just about Comcast. As you've heard, there's an example of NORPAC in Marion County. There are other large value appeals that are not budgeted. And when there is a settlement or a decision, then, as you heard, the payment of the settlement, if it accrues to the taxpayer with interest, is paid out of the current unsegregated tax account. So current local taxing districts pay that. The AOC was so concerned about this and the unpleasant surprises that we've had that they called a work group last fall of all direct stakeholders in the property tax collection system. That included the Confederation of School Administrators, the Oregon School Boards Association, League of Cities, Special Districts Association, community colleges, assessors, tax collectors, commissioners. We had two meetings, one in November and one in December, looked at a number of alternatives. We had generous technical help from Department of Revenue. And as one of our members from the League of Cities said, this assessor concept is the best bad answer to it. There isn't anything that's really quite satisfying about what to do as an alternative to current law, but this is better than the other alternatives and is certainly better than current law.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If it is on $1 million of value, I would say Section 1 is unclear on that. And so if this goes forward, it would need some clarifying language. Secondly, your very statement that AOC has been concerned about it, followed up previously with Mr. Worth's comment about 500 applicable cases out of the last 6 years, tells me that if this many cases are being challenged, that then there is a significant issue with overassessment and causing that many taxpayers then to have to rebut the assessment through the appeal process. So, I don't think that the concern with removing the risk from the counties is unwarranted by your own very language.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Air Brewer, the economics has a lot to play it here. We have seen values, and we've seen it through time in the 80s, for example, with the milling operations in the wood products industry. They will be assessed at a certain rate, and then the economy will change quickly. And this may be a question that you should more properly address to the Department of Revenue, since they handle the larger accounts. And we have talked with them about this, and it's a difficult job. It's always engages in some guesswork, but I think they do, and I know the assessors do the best they can based on the current economic situation, and that has changed, can change, and has changed. But you did remind me of something. I appreciate that. Thank you. There's also an issue that the assessors and commissioners need to sort out. On Monday, they plan to talk about it, and that is who should have the authority to issue the credits. Should it be the Board of County Commissioners? Should it be the governing body, or should it be the assessors? So that's something that that we're going to be talking about within the county family on Monday. So this bill is, we see that as a concept, a solid concept, but as you've seen, it needs a little bit of fine-tuning.
Yes.
May I respond?
Yes.
Chair. Chair Brewer, I think I can clarify something in Section 1-1 there. You were saying that you thought the language is unclear as to whether it's referring to taxes or property value. And the language is if the dollar amount at issue exceeds $1 million. In property tax appeals, the taxes are not at issue. It's always the value of property. And so when I read that language, I saw that relating to the value of property and not the taxes. But if that's not clarifying enough, I'm sure something could be put in there.
Okay. Is there anyone else? Do you have a question?
Well, yeah. And if I may, Madam Chair, a comment as well. This seems to me to be one of these really tough issues, because there are times when you cannot tell what the outcome, you can't predict what the outcome is going to be because of the legal questions that are before the court in the case. Now, I haven't read the briefs, and so this is a shorthand and it may not be entirely accurate, but if I understand the issue involving the cable companies correctly, we're really dealing with a legal question.
Precisely.
As to whether or not the current statute referring to communications companies, telecommunications companies, I think it is, actually includes cable companies for the purpose of centralized assessment. If they're included, then they're included for the essentially the fair market value of the company. If they're excluded, then they're assessed based on the value of the real and personal property used in for business purposes, and those are very different numbers. You can't, without an answer to the legal question, are they included in the statute, yes or no, you can't tell what the valuation is. You might actually be able to come up with two numbers pretty easily, but which of the two numbers you apply is the legal question that you have to consider. This issue is one of those where the agencies that are actually going to spend the money are the ones that are on the hook for any misguess that either the assessor or the department makes on either valuation or on the kind of legal question like as the one I'm describing here. One further comment. The 12% interest cannot possibly be an attempt to penalize the assessor, since the assessor is not going to have to pay the money. The money is paid by the agencies that otherwise would have received the benefit of the property tax in the first place. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I was anticipating that perhaps someone else in the room might want to speak to this issue. Mr. Dewey, you want to come up and on this particular bill? If you come up. Right.
Shall we leave?
Thank you. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association, of which Comcast has been a member. What I wanted to do is very quickly just clarify that I understand the dilemma the Department of Revenues and the counties are in the sense that I do understand that some counties have spent some of this money already that is in question. The first issue in Co-Chair Representative Barnhart hit the nail on the head is, I mean, obviously we have a substantial difference between the local assessment and the central assessment. And this is going to take a little bit longer in terms of these present cases than I think has been represented here. In the case of Comcast, it's my understanding the plaintiff Comcast, we've already had the trial at the tax court. The judge wants to do a good job of getting everything on the record because there is no question that this case will be appealed by either the state or Comcast because the values are so substantial and we're creating new law, if you will, at least we do. We believe the Department of Revenue has. Not going to talk about the legal aspects of this. So the first part of this is whether or not Comcast is subject to central assessment. The next part is what's the value if they are? And so these are very complicated entities. And there are a whole list of other plaintiffs that are lined up after Comcast. And if Comcast comes in under central assessment, I would not assume that the other companies are going to believe they are subject to central assessment in that Comcast is a different entity than some other cable companies. Comcast a couple weeks ago just completed the purchase of NBC. Very few companies have that kind of leverage. My understanding that Microsoft is in the queue and Yahoo is also in the queue. And one thing I just want to be clear here is that the these lawsuits don't, if you change the statute, and I understand you should have this conversation, that the 12% doesn't affect the companies that are in the queue. The last thing I'd say is that with regard to these kinds of large cases, if you think about it, at the end of the day, if Comcast or somebody else prevails, in some ways they will be a villain here. Because this is money that some school or county or city thought was due to them, and somehow the legal system took it away from them. So it is a dilemma for Comcast in the sense that they have customers and care about the customers. So if there is this refund that would have gone back to schools, for example, which you want to fund and I want to fund, it's, you know, they have a dilemma. But they also had a fiduciary right and a responsibility for their stakeholders. So it is complicated. I hope you can get it right. I understand the dilemma you have here, but I wanted to make sure that you understood that these cases are going to go forward and there are a bunch in the queue and the facts are all different.
Any questions for Mike? Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
For coming forward on this. Okay, are we ready to leave this one behind and go to the next two? Since it's a similar panel, I'll let you. Let's go on to 2570, or are you still on 2569 or all three?
No, Madam Chair.
2569.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sean O'Day. I'm the Deputy City Manager for the City of Salem. With me today is Douglas Gabbard, who's a financial analyst in our finance department. We wanted to testify just briefly on 2569 to let you know that we are testifying in support of this bill. As one of the previous speakers noted, this is probably the best imperfect solution we can find to this particular problem. And from our perspective, the issue, although the interest is certainly a big issue, the other issue with state, the current state of state law, is the inequities that the current reserve account creates. Specifically, in the case of the Comcast appeal, because the counties must create the reserve account under state law out of the unsegregated account, it ends up hitting the various taxing jurisdictions inequitably from what the amount of taxes they otherwise would have received from that particular entity. Specifically, or by example, with the City of Salem, with the Comcast appeal, but for that appeal, we would have been receiving about $90,000 a year in revenue. But because of the way that state law requires the county to create this reserve account, we end up foregoing approximately $180,000 in taxes. Because the deferred billing credit would basically remove that inequity, by keeping the taxes with the appealing party, we don't receive that sort of hit, and it's for that reason that we are in support of this legislation today. We do think, however, that the bill could be improved in three particular ways. One, as previously mentioned, there is an intent that the bill be retroactive, that it allow for a credit for a prior year. That wording's not actually in the bill. We think that wording like that or wording to that effect would improve the bill and improve the intent that it be retroactive. We also noted that the $1 million in tax threshold, we think this is a tool that should be used sparingly, so we think the threshold should be high. We also noted the ambiguity in the bill, that it's not entirely clear. Is this $1 million in taxes that's in dispute or $1 million of assessed value on the property? And in fact, I can tell you that we've received different, after sitting here through the testimony today, we've received different answers from our own county assessor that it was intended to be $1 million in dispute versus the assessed value. So we agree that that's certainly a provision of the bill that should be improved and clarified. And then finally, one of the issues that we've noted when you have a deferred billing credit is this issue of what happens on the back end of the case. What if the taxpayer is not successful in that appeal but subsequently becomes insolvent? You've heard that these cases take a long time to resolve, and so the tax bill that accrues can become quite large. We are a little bit concerned, and again, we recognize this is probably the best imperfect solution to the current problem that we're experiencing, but this is an issue of concern to us. We don't have a particular solution in mind, but we do note that we do run a risk with this particular solution in facing an insolvent taxpayer at the end of the dispute, and then perhaps foregoing or losing out on some of those taxes that would have otherwise been owing. Of course, state law does provide that taxes will take a first priority on the property, which puts us in a good position. But again, you know, keep in mind that these cases do take a long time to resolve, and you know, with property values being as they may, it's, you know, in any given case, it may be that you end up being upside down, and so that's a risk, a small risk, but a risk nonetheless that we wanted to know.
Questions for my city? Is there anyone further on this particular bill? I'm sitting and conferring with my co-chair here, and we think that this is an issue that is ripe for a little work group to try and get this right. We're kind of looking for volunteers from our committee who would like to sit in on with the assessors and Representative Wan,
yeah,
and Representative
I'll
Brewer.
Jump in, sure.
And we might encourage Mr. Dewey to sit in on that if we can, and the assessors group to try and get this right for us.
And the department.
And the department, certainly. Anyone else, Mr. Chair, that you can think of that?
Oh.
Yeah. yeah. Counties. We will set this up through our staff. Okay?
Thank you.
Well, and Madam Chair, I think that that's the most expeditious way of getting several of these issues addressed at once and maybe having an amendment crafted that will deal with all of the concerns.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you. Clearly, this is not ready for prime time, but I think there is a need to get it ready for prime time this session, and the only way to do that is to get the right people in the room and get it worked. And get some agreed upon concepts and language. Paul, thank you. The next two, who wants to talk on 2570? I've got the Multnomah County again. And the county clerks. Just for Carol's sake, you can re-identify yourselves before you speak.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Berger and Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. Again, I'm Annette Spickard from the Lane County Assessor's Office and also the State Association of County Assessors. House Bill 2570, which Ms. Roniak already explained to you, is a language clarification bill so that we are treating bona fide purchasers the same when we make roll corrections, whether we make the correction to the roll in the current tax year or we discover a correction that needs to be made to a prior tax roll. And so the association had a meeting with the Department of Revenue to discuss the different language that's in the current statutes that causes a different treatment of taxpayers depending on what year we find and need to make a roll correction. And so we're just bringing forward to you this suggestion to clarify that so that if a person purchases a piece of property in the current tax year, which is or in the current assessment year, excuse me, which is any time between January 1 and by the tax roll in October, that they be treated the same as a taxpayer who purchased his property in that same window, but we discover a correction in a later year and go back and fix it, that the timing should be the same under either circumstance for how they're responsible or not for any prior taxes. So, I don't know if you have it.
So
Jed helped us again to draft the concept with legislative counsel so he can speak to the legal portion.
To questions of the committee, and from my reading, it's a clarification of what exactly assessment date means
right.
in the statute and its date the roll was certified in.
For the roll correction process,
yeah. Yeah, cool.
Because if we have the duty and the responsibility to go through every year after we certify the roll to the next year we certify the roll from October to October, we're correcting accounts, people buy and sell property, change the names, you know, if there's new property added, we just do that as a regular course of business so that they get a correct tax statement in October. And so if someone purchases a property prior to certification in October of a current year and we've looked at the account and corrected that new ownership and everything, okay, great. But in the out years, under the current law, if we discover a correction that needs to be made and we need to go back to that point in time when they purchased it, we cannot apply taxes to that first year that they bought it, which doesn't seem fair to the people that do pay those current year taxes in the year that they buy the property. So I hope that's clear.
Questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to figure out, and I can't recall, when one orders a title report on the property, if you're representing the buyer, you look at the statement on the report for the taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll have to tell me what that title officer looked at when she prepared the report for us. Does this make their job more difficult? Does it change it at all? Does it mean there's a longer period of time for which the buyer of property is now at risk than was the case before?
I'm not sure from the title company perspective if it makes it any more difficult or not. So they will pull from our records, as you may know, what the current tax bill is. They can look and see how we have the property characterized and assessed and pull a lot of information directly from our records. What happens in an error correction situation is there's something about the property physically that we don't have in our records. So they would pull our records, look at that. It's the best of our knowledge of what's physically there and how it's being assessed. But if there's something additional there or some other reason we need to make a correction, so we discover these things later on. Let's say we go out and reappraise the whole neighborhood and we find out that there's something that needs to be fixed on those accounts. Then we have the ability under the current law to go back and fix it up to five prior tax years or the point that the bona fide purchaser bought the property, except in this first year. Does that make sense? Does that help?
Yes.
Well, it does make sense. I think the question would be what the title company's position would be on this language change and whether their standard exceptions encompass that which we're about in this bill.
Okay.
Representative Bentz, Randy Waller from Multnomah County Assessor. What the title company would show will not change because of this. After July 1st, on July 1st, the taxes become a lien, but they're not determined for that fiscal year. We certify the roll in October, so the title report would show taxes not yet to be determined are a lien on the property. We determine those taxes and certify the roll in October. Annette referenced a situation where you discover an error later on. A real straightforward error that could be that the previous January 1st, there was a brand new home on the property. For some reason, when that October bill went out, we didn't have the house on the record, vacant lot. If you'd owned that property prior to January 1st, you're responsible for those taxes. And in fact, the bona fide purchaser says that you're only responsible for taxes that were a matter of public record at the time you purchased the property. That's why the certification date is so important. So if you purchase the property before the certification date, the taxes are a lien but not known. This clears up an issue in the statutes where, oddly, we found that it said that in the year of purchase, if you didn't own it on January 1st. Well, there was no way to know the previous January 1st that we were going to leave the taxes off. So two owners of property, one purchasing the property on December 31st, the other on January 2nd, they're still in the same position that following October. But this corrects the situation so that they're both subject to the same correction and paying the same taxes. They own that property. They're living in that home. We discovered the error. The taxes could not have been known until that following October. So they purchased that property, and they should anticipate that home will be on the tax roll that fall. We should be able to correct this roll and treat all taxpayers equally in this regard. And this was a glitch that we found. How it came to be, it's hard to say without a lot of research, because with Measure 5, Measure 50, we've changed the assessment dates and a number of dates back and forth over the years. And this oddly came up last year and caught us all off guard. And that's why we truly believe it's clarifying to keep consistency.
Further question?
I'll just mention that without sitting down and drawing out what you just said, I have no idea if you're right. That's the truth. I'll take your word for it. My main concern is that those that we represent when they're buying understand they may be slightly at risk. Am I hearing that? They wouldn't necessarily be able to rely upon the title report. Because I think that's what I just heard. If they buy it incorrectly, they're still at risk, or not.
Not for previous years prior to when they purchased it. If you purchase that property the day after we certify that roll, you are not responsible for any prior taxes that we now determine. So that's where the stopping point is when we go back and look when you purchased the property. We certify the roll. October 8th. If you purchased the property before October 8th, those taxes were not known. You were purchasing it knowing that they were still to be determined. If you purchased it after October 8th.
I understand. Okay. Thank you.
Yes, and I can tell you that the this is a public hearing, and if the title companies have an issue, they generally show up. So we would encourage them to. Representative Benz. Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You raised some very interesting points. I think the example you gave, purchaser who understands at least a modicum of what the property tax system works like would certainly know that the few hundred dollars that were paid on the property last year don't apply when there's a house on it this year. And so, you know, whether they've actually gotten a tax statement that shows the new tax amount or not, they certainly know that that's very likely to be coming when you get to it anyway. I have a couple of slightly different questions. And I'm not sure whether they're actually related to this bill or not, but let me ask them and we'll see. Let's suppose this house that we were talking about was not built in January of this year, but January 5 years ago, and we didn't know about it, or you didn't know about it, and you kept the property taxes kept being a couple hundred dollars a year, and then the house and the property was sold on January 1st or 2nd, whatever the date is, and you discover
a vacant lot.
Sometime later that it's not a vacant lot. Now, I understand that what this bill does is that if you haven't figured it out in October, if you haven't got it figured out by the October certification date, that you have the right to go back to the tax year that begins after the purchaser bought the property in July and add that assessment to it. But what about the years before that? When the earlier property owner should have been paying taxes but didn't. Is anybody on the hook for those taxes? And if so, who, and how would you go about collecting them?
Chair Barnhart, Randy Walker, Noah County. Only the real property is the security for the property taxes. So a bona fide purchaser allows the previous owner to escape.
That answers my question.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions on this? Do you want to continue on with House Bill 2572?
Sure. I can sling it.
For the record, Jed Tompkins, Assistant Multnomah County Attorney, describing the way we understand House Bill 2572. There's a conflict between the way local governments assess property and the way the components of a property tax account may be appealed. Counties and assessors assess property tax accounts as a whole. However, taxpayers currently may appeal just components of that. But our assessors our appraisers are not going out there and assigning a single value to various components of the property tax account. There's a total value assigned at the end. And the issue is that we do list on the assessment tax roll a value for the land and a value for the improvements. And a taxpayer may appeal just one of those values. And the problem for local governments is, okay, maybe the value on that component, maybe the taxpayer is correct that the value is different than what we have on the roll. However, the assessor may not agree that the total value of the property is properly reduced by whatever reduction the taxpayer is pointing to for the component. And so, in other words, if a taxpayer is looking to reduce the value of the taxpayer's land, we may go out, we may even agree, or the court may decide, yes, the value of the land on the roll is too high. However, we may have plenty of appropriate evidence that the court would accept to show that, okay, even though the land is had a value on the roll that was too high, the overall value of the account was about right. And this bill would allow us to, however, currently we can't go in and say, but the whole account is right. We just have to defend the component that's being appealed and then reduce the total value. And so we can end up with underassessed property tax accounts. This bill would allow a party to raise any other component that's so if there's a component appeal, any other party could bring in the other components or all the other components or the entire property tax account into issue so that we can get the total value of the property tax account correct.
Questions? Yes, Representative Warren.
I'll just make a comment. I guess it's not really a question. I have a real concern about this bill because it seems to very dramatically alter the balance of power in the litigation. I call it litigation in the appeal because it takes it away from the appealing party who has the burden of proof coming forward and setting the terms of engagement, so to speak. And it transfers it around so that the government can come in and say, oh, well, you filed an appeal on this component, I'm going to double down and make your life even more miserable by reopening the entire file as a form of retribution to discourage appeals. And I don't know that I can solve for that concern. I really don't. And I think I would have to get much deeper in the weeds to understand all the complexities of that dynamic, but it's a real concern to me.
Representing Juan. Rainy Wall from McMillan County Assessor. This came out as a situation in the fact that, I want to clarify, it's our requirement by statute to issue a tax statement showing a separate value for land and improvements. This has become much more of a problem under Measure 50, and I can explain that in a moment. But we still value and tax the account as a unit of property. The statutes even discuss a unit of property, including more than one account, the value of a unit of property. We've had these situations more so in recent years where the taxpayer will appeal a component of value, either the land or the improvements. We have the total right. But then what happens is because of the fact that they filed the appeal, and in our county, we're appraising and issuing tax statements on 345,000 accounts a year. They get one component lowered, and that lowers the total overall, when in fact a number of our appraisals are a residual method. In Multnomah County, as an example, in residential properties, there's very few vacant land sales. There's very little vacant land. So we use an appraisal method called the residual method, and the improvements are residual. Someone doesn't walk up to an older property and look at it and say, now I'm going to pay $600,000, of which I think $200,000 is going for the land, $400,000 is going for the improvements. They look at the total property, and they make a purchase price. But our situation has arisen in various cases that the property's worth $1 million, but then the assessor had one of the components wrong, and then the appeal of that component is resolved appropriately, but to the detriment of the total value, and then it's locked into the Measure 50 value, especially if it's the exception event year, whether it was new land or new improvements. So you end up with a situation where, in a simple example, the property's worth $1 million, and we allocated $300,000 to the land and $700,000 to the improvement. And for whatever reason, one of those components is lowered, but we weren't able, and the magistrate wasn't able to look at the total to get the answer right. And I look at it as we take this job on of sending out all these tax bills, and the taxpayers open it up and they say, something's wrong, I need to appeal. It's the courts in the past that gave them this right to do the individual component appeal. And so they're saying it's wrong. Well, we need to get it right. So the risk here is that in the end, we don't have the wrong value on the roll, even though we corrected one part of the component. Let's get it right.
Okay. Further questions? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to comment then, perhaps the issue, perhaps the solution is not to change the opportunity for any party to the appeal to bring in all components. Perhaps the solution might be for the county assessors to change their methodology, as you mentioned, the residual method. Maybe that's inherently flawed, maybe there's a different way that you can assess the components rather than changing the rights in an appeal process.
Representative Brewer, the residual method is one of the accepted appraisal methods by the all the appraisal institutes, and there would be no other way of determining values and number of property. That is the issue here at hand, is we can come up with the total value. The allocation is quite difficult and complex, and that's the statutes require the two separate values. The issue here is we're not taking away the rights to appeal the components, because there's reasons why to get them correct. Measure 50 requires that, whether it could be new land, it could be improvements to the land, it could be new improvements or portions of the improvements. It could be the exception amount, like the value of an add-on or a remodel. The taxpayers need to have the right to be able to appeal that, and we want to maintain those rights. But what we want in the end is to step back and have the right value on the property and the correct Measure 50 value. And I don't see any other way to get there. In an ideal environment where you have plenty of land sales of the type of land that you have and plenty of construction costs and a lot of new properties, it becomes much easier to do as you say. But the problem that we're dealing with now is built-up communities with old structures and a number of other factors that come into play that makes valuation quite complex.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds, you know, when you first talked about this, I was thinking, well, this isn't a big deal. A clever person who was interested in appealing an error in one component might get a little windfall for a year, and then, of course, you would fix it in the next year. But, of course, with Measure 50, you can't. This inequity to the other taxpayers will continue forever if you don't get to the correct value of the overall property the first time. I think that's the concern that you have, if I understand you correctly. It isn't simply that a taxpayer might get a windfall in 1 year. It's that the property is misvalued forever.
Representative Barnhart, Randy Wolf, Multnomah County. That's exactly correct. Measure 50 has locked into forever, as far as we can see, any errors that occur in that Measure 50 exception event year. We already have in the statutes the adjudicate law statute that says once a property is adjudicated, that value carries forward for 5 years. And so even if we made an error there, we don't fix it for 5 years. We can go out and reappraise it then. And that's to keep assessors from just going back out the next year and to provide some certainty for the taxpayers. But Measure 50, in the event of the exception event, you've hit right on it. We have this error, a substantial undervaluation of the property as a whole, a Measure 50 event. You live with it forever.
Further questions or comments? Okay, I think...
Chair Berger, yes. may I just
I just wanted to follow on both Chair Barnhart's and Randy's comments here. This bill is targeted at those situations that can create an improper undervaluation of the entire property tax account. As Randy mentioned, the ability to appeal a property tax account component is still available under this bill. And there are a lot of good reasons to still appeal your property tax account component. Good reasons, not reasons that are going to result in an improper undervaluation. Exception events. If you add a bedroom onto your house and you think that the assessor has assigned a value that's too high to it, you can appeal just that exception value. And so that's a good instance. Owners of investment property would like to see accurate assessments of the improvements to land because depreciation is important to them. Owners of special commercial property may seek a very accurate determination of the value of their land because they want it valued at the highest and best use. So there's still very good reasons that will continue under this bill for people to bring property tax account component appeals.
One question. Can you use the term unit of property? And in income tax, of course, that's very distinct. So in the property tax world, unit of property, are the improvements on the land a separate unit of property than the land itself?
Representative Brewer, Randy Waldorf. No. We have situations where, as an example, an apartment complex could have 8, 9, 12 buildings. Sometimes it's on 3 or 4 different land accounts, and so we have an improvement account that's associated with each land account. We're tasked with identifying the improvements on each legally described piece of property. But all those accounts combined is a unit of property.
Okay, so a unit of property can include multiple tax lots and multiple structures.
That's correct.
And so when you assess a tax value, or you assess a value, it's based on the tax lots, and it may or may not include a complete unit of property on there. So you could, say, on one tax lot have 2 of the 5 structures in an apartment complex, and that would only be a partial unit of property.
That's correct.
So it's the reason why you separate out land from improvements is statutorily required?
That's correct.
And otherwise, you would not be doing that. There would be no reason for you to do that?
Well, I believe that there's a reason to do it because we always want to appraise land as vacant and ready for highest and best use. And then you build on top of that. And the theory in the tax laws would be if those improvements were to be destroyed or damaged and go away tomorrow, we still know the value of the underlying land. It all begins with the land as the foundation.
So why do you want to value the land at the highest and best use? Why is that a given?
The improvements are a depreciating asset, but the land is not. So if the land as vacant is residential property, then we have a foundation for the land value right there. It's the given. It's the known.
So if
further
it's
questions.
Oh, I'm sorry. So, thank you. Procedure I'm learning. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your latitude. So if that's a given and a known, then aren't you in this law, in this, as you propose it in this bill, allowing the county a second bite at the apple to get it right if the land value is the known?
I guess you were allowing the tax court to get it right. I'll let Jed answer that.
I don't think that that's a proper characterization, Vice Chair Brewer, Jed Tompkins for Multnomah County, only because the idea here is that this bill is addressing a situation where the overall value is correct, and we are addressing circumstances in which
although the overall value of the property tax account is correct, we are bound by existing laws and rules of the court to accept a lower value if one of the components that we're required to list on the tax roll by statute is inaccurate. But the total value, these are we're addressing situations where the total value is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Ripsey and Pence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having handled some of these appeals, I want to ask if it's been your experience that when you reach the hearing and you're in front of the tax court, the appraiser and other folks that you have available could be narrowly focused on one of those components, but you have the appraiser there. You have the tools in place, if you are the taxpayer, to address both all components. And so initially I had the same thought that Representative Wan had, which was this is allowing an unfair opportunity for the assessor to expand the scope of the discussion, but I'm not sure we could have a complete discussion without expanding it. And if the tools, I've just been really asking if it's been your experience that the taxpayer arrives with an appraiser and thus already has incurred the cost of that person or that professional. And to expand this discussion to include the entire picture is going to be a kind of a necessary part of a discussion of the component. So I'm really trying to get at, does this law impose a higher cost upon a taxpayer who appeals just the component and then finds the discussion expanded to include the entire realm of property valuation?
Representative Bentz, Randy Walker, Multnomah County. Speaking in generalities, generally in these kinds of cases, the taxpayers are well represented and they've had the property thoroughly appraised and they do have an appraiser presence. Their appraiser needed to go through the same steps as we did. I, without having the specific numbers in the case in front of me, I do know of a case where it was agreed by both sides that the value of the property was in the vicinity of $11 million. They appealed the component of the land only. The land value, the assessor had it too high. It was lowered to $3 million. It was an exception event year for the entire property. So now the value of the property went on the roll at $9 million total, not $11 million. And this is embedded in history now for Measure 50. And this is one example of many examples that could be brought forward of getting the right answer on one of the components ends up with the wrong answer on the property as a total, and this taxpayer will not be paying the taxes based on the market value of the property as determined under Measure 50 if the court could have the opportunity to get the account right.
Thank you for that, and that does focus on the larger issue, which is trying to get the answer right. I was actually focused on a little bitty issue of cost to the person doing the appeal, because it seemed to me that you're going to have an appraiser there. You could do the broader picture as well as the narrow, not for the same amount, but certainly you already have an appraiser in place. It's already pretty expensive. But you're better. The point you make is, what are we trying to get at? And that is the correct value. That's what the law says we're supposed to try to do. You're trying to get the law so you can get there. I agree with what you're trying to do. Further discussion is probably necessary, but I think you're going in the right direction.
Okay.
Chair Berger, may I? Representative Benz, I'm not sure that one can say that this, as a generality, would add cost to a taxpayer, and that's because it's often an approach of a taxpayer's appraiser, their expert appraiser, to determine the value of the component that's at issue in the appeal by first determining the other component, and I think you were talking about this. In those situations where the appraiser was simply going to look at one component, maybe there's an added cost there, but that's, I'm not sure if one of those situations is more common than the other, really.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Anyone else out there who would like to come forward and add to this discussion on any of these bills? I failed to mention when we put together this work group on 2569 that the League of Oregon Cities would be included, and I meant to. Any further discussion? Thank you. Thank you for coming in, all of you. an interesting discussion on property taxes and possible changes. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2572, 2570, and 2569. Did I get them right? And we're going to get out a little early, so I'm going to adjourn this meeting of the Revenue Committee. Thank you. And,
thank you.
And Representative Brewer and Representative Benz. Representative Benz.